to Tea, Tonic, and Toxin, a book club and podcast for anyone who wants to explore the best mysteries and thrillers ever written. I'm your host, Sarah Harrison.
And I'm your host, Carolyn Daughters. Pour yourself a cup of tea, a gin and tonic,
but not a toxin,
and join us on a journey through 19th and 20th century mysteries and thrillers, every one of them a game changer.
We are very excited about today's episode, still the continuation of the 39 Steps, part two. I messed up the script, but I'm still going to keep going. It's the 39 Steps, part two. If you haven't listened to part one, well, you can go back, but it's not like in order or anything. So you can start here if you want. Today, we also have our super amazing second special guest of the year, Wendy Anderson.
You don't know my name, do you?
I knew the Wendy. I forgot the Anderson.
It is all professional here.
I'm really good at podcasting.
Our very special guest. Let me go through.
Okay, before we dive into deeper to what Sarah doesn't know, we want to make sure to mention our fantastic sponsor today, Linden Botanicals. Colorado-based Linden Botanicals sells the world's healthiest herbal teas and extracts. Their team has traveled the globe to find the herbs that offer the best science-based support for stress relief, energy, memory, mood, kidney health, joint health, immune health, inflammation, and digestion. U.S. orders over $75, ship free. To learn more and get 15% off your first order, visit lindenbotanicals.com. Thank you, Linden Botanicals.
Thank you.
We also have a listener award. Today's listener award goes to Dwayne Howe from Denver, Colorado. Dwayne is a recent listener, and he is actually reading the books and then listening to the podcasts of the books that he has read. You too can do this and win a sticker. Dwayne's going to get a sticker, and thank you for being amazing and for being a member of our book club. We appreciate you.
We do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And these stickers are really pretty.
They're really cool. They're like the nice stickers that you put on your computer or your water bottle or other things that you reserve for sticking stickers on. Mm-hmm. Don't give them to your kids. They just stick them on the floor and you will regret it.
Do not give them to... We have all the advice here. Yeah. Real world advice.
They'll stick them exactly where you don't want to stick your stickers. But you can get one and stick it where you want to stick your stickers.
And so, Sarah... How would they leave comments and things like that?
Well, you can go to teatonicandtoxin.com. I think for any book, you can enter book-specific comments, or you can go on our social, on Instagram at teatonicandtoxin, or Facebook, and just make some comments, say some stuff.
If you even gave us, I don't know, like a 5-star review,
yeah,
we would probably send you a sticker. Am I right?
Yeah, we're generous, loving people. And we will send you a sticker.
if we do say so ourselves.
We're kind, we're warm-hearted, sticker-oriented people. So.
The 39 Steps. I want to tell you a little bit about this book because some of you listeners may not have read it yet, may have read it a long time ago, or maybe in the middle of it, and you're like, I cannot miss this podcast, and we appreciate that. The 39 Steps is an adventure spy novel by John Buchan, I think. The action-packed story begins in May 1914. Richard Hannay is a Scotsman who lived in Rhodesia and has since moved to London. One day he finds a man named Franklin Scudder at his door. Scudder is a freelance spy who has secret information about an assassination plot that could lead to a world war. Days later, Hannay finds Scudder murdered in his flat. Fearing for his life, Hannay goes on the run, hiding out in Scotland. His goal is to stay one step ahead of both the police and the spies, who will stop at nothing to find him. After breaking a cryptic code, he learns that German spies called the Blackstone plan to steal British military intelligence. He confides in an innkeeper, who then sends a letter to his godfather, the innkeeper's godfather, Sir Walter Bullivant, the secretary of the Foreign Office. Still on the run, Hané ends up at a remote Scottish mansion owned by an old man, who turns out to be part of Blackstone. The old man locks Hané in a storeroom, but Hané escapes by setting off a homemade bomb. From there, Hané heads back to London and meets up with Sir Walter Bullivant. Hané, Bullivant, and British officials discuss the sinister German plot and try to figure out where the Blackstone will leave England. Hané recalls a cryptic note describing 39 steps. Hané identifies the departure point in Kent, scopes out the area, and accuses three men of being Blackstone spies. Those men are arrested. Weeks later, the UK goes to war, its secret naval defense plans intact. Today, we're excited to talk about The 39 Steps, one of the most popular espionage thrillers ever written. Since it was published in 1915, it has inspired countless books, along with Alfred Hitchcock's 1935 film adaptation. It's our second book selection of 2023. It's actually our third. I was just teasing you there. It is our third. It's our third book selection for 2023. You can find all of our 2023 book selections on our website at teatonicandtoxin.com.
Oh, who's messing it up now? Not merely Sarah.
No, no.
Oh, we got another thing wrong. I just realized in the summary that there's the innkeeper, and then there's Sir Harry, the political candidate, and it's Sir Harry's godfather, not the innkeeper's godfather.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that when I read through it. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about our awesome guest today, whose name I know, definitely, is Wendy Anderson. And I know how to spell it. It's Wendy with an I. Wendy is a senior business analyst and an avid outdoor enthusiast. She loves mountain biking, hiking, and paddleboarding. In fact, one of her favorite activities is jogging up Green Mountain. Elevation, 6,800 feet, because she's tough, which is just steps outside her home in lovely Golden, Colorado. When she's not exploring the great outdoors, watching horror movies, or reading Stephen King novels, she's hanging at home with her husband, two kids, and two dogs. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
Wendy, is being a senior business analyst, like, is it attractive? Is the mystery element to these books attractive to your analyst mind, or is it totally unrelated?
Actually, that's a good question. I hadn't thought about it before, but yes, it is attractive.
I would think so.
Yeah, very much. I think that's why I like serial killer and horror, and because there's just so many, there's so much to think about and analyze.
Do you ever like get there first and you solve it before everyone?
Sometimes, but not as much as I'd like.
Yeah, it's so hard.
Did you mean in her job, or did you mean when she's reading Stephen King?
I mean reading. I assume in her job she solves everything first.
Yes, and then has to sit around impatiently waiting for everyone else to come.
Like trying to explain it and explain it.
It's rough waiting for people like I do.
So would it be more fun to you to read the books or watch the horror film and to know, like to figure it out before maybe other people would figure it out or before some of the characters? Or is it more fun to be shocked and to say at the end, oh my gosh, I had no idea? Like, which is more fun?
Well, the intellectual part of me says you should figure this out way before the end. But the other part of me loves the shock factor and not knowing what's going to happen, because honestly, that's what makes the movie or the novel fun, is being in suspense the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after a while, I'm like, well, I've guessed every person, so I'm definitely going to be right by the end.
So because you've named them right, all.
Like, so. Oh, when I thought that one, that's when I was right.
That's called hedging your bets, yeah.
But they design them that way, so.
They do.
It's all fair.
Yeah. So we have a lot to talk about with this book. We've done a podcast episode already, and we loved it so much, even though it's 100 and some odd pages, short and a fast read, we have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, should we talk a little? I like the milk of human kindness. And that was a funny way to put it, especially since the humans feed him milk with whiskey when he needs some kindness. So
Richard Hannay in this book, time and time again, runs into a variety of people who help him along his journey. Whether it's a milkman that he's able to, you know, work a deal out and let me put on your uniform, or knocks on somebody's door and they let him into his house, or, hey, let me do your job for you. I'm going to pose as a roadman or worker. Over and over again, he is super persuasive with everybody he meets. And they come on board. If he doesn't share the truth with them, they don't ask questions. If he does share the truth with them, they believe him. They give him room, board, Scottish whiskey.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you?
Well, so that's a great question. Why wouldn't you? Or flip it, why would you?
Well, in this case, as I thought it was pretty irresponsible of Henny to, like, endanger everyone. That was super nice to him, but luckily they suffered no ill consequences like he is. But yeah, we were talking a little bit about this before the show, and I've definitely not to like the level of issue that Henny has, but so okay. It's funny to predate smartphones, right? And be like, I'm older than smartphones. I know this because I was always lost as a driver. I was always lost in every place I ever lived. Growing up, from the time I could drive till I got my first smartphone when I was like 35. Mm-hmm. So between all that time, I'm lost. And I'm not a little bit lost. Mm-hmm. I'm really lost. And so I very frequently throughout my life have just had to like call it, pull over the car, walk up to someone's house and be like, where am I? Mm. Can I please use your phone and call somebody?
You've done this.
Multiple times around the country. Yeah.
Really?
What else am I going to do? I don't know where I am. I can't figure it out. I'm hours out of the way.
There's no gas station?
I can't understand what they're saying. I don't know. No. Okay. It wasn't. I don't know where, like, Indiana roads. Have you guys been in the Midwest?
Wait,
have
you can't driven there? Indiana, you can't understand what they're saying?
No, but you can't find, you're just, there's nothing.
Okay.
There's nothing.
Okay.
There's fields and people. Mm-hmm. It's not like every road has a gas station anyway. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and if you go to a gas station and you're like, I'm from Brownsburg, and they're like, well, I don't know where that is because I'm 2 hours lost. Mm-hmm. So frequently what I'd have to do is I have to just like call somebody to like come get me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm completely inept here, folks. And yeah, no, I've had to stop multiple times and use people's phones and go into their house and ask them where I'm at. Show me a map, something. Get me on the road.
Give you a meal and some whiskey.
No, I don't think, although I remember one time I was especially young. I think I was under 20. And so I did end up having to call my mom, and I think I was like 2 hours lost. And so I had to wait a really long time in this like nice lady's kitchen. And I think she did offer me like something, some water or something like that.
No milk with whiskey.
No. But I do come up, right? And they give me this look at first like, why are you at my house? And I proceed to tell them my stupid story. And then you can see the realization that this girl is telling the truth, and yes, you can come in and use the phone, you dummy. So
what is that realization? How are they knowing you're, is it?
Well, I can see it in their eyes. Okay. I can see it shift from suspicion to a desire to be helpful to another lost human.
But they're seeing something in your eyes where they're saying, okay, this person on my door is telling me a true story.
Yeah, they can discern the truth. Okay. At first they don't know, and then I tell them, and they're like, oh, I feel you. Mm-hmm. And that's what you see happening in this book over and over and over again, and they're always saying stuff like that, like, I see you're the right kind of fellow, or I could tell by his eyes and his fear that he was telling the truth. And there's always some things that clue you in when someone's telling the truth, and if you don't get that sense, you don't let them in. But if you are telling the truth, or you do get that sense, then you can let them come in and use your phone and use a map or something.
So, Wendy, have you ever done this? You just pull up to somebody's house, knock on their door, and you're like, hey, I need some help. Here's my paper. You know, do you guys remember those books of maps?
Oh, yeah, I still have them. I still have them.
The Atlas. Yeah.
Or any map.
It'd be of a geographic area. So when I was in D.C., we'd have a D.C. one.
Yeah, sure.
And it was thick. And, you know, with all the, you know, you'd be like, here's my map. Where am I?
Mm-hmm.
Have you done this, Wendy?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
And while Sarah was talking, I made a note to myself to not travel with her. But yes, I'm very, very bad with directions and maps. And I, too, was absolutely thrilled at the invention of the smartphone with directions.
Mm-hmm.
Someone to just tell me where to go. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I ever knocked on anyone's house to ask for directions, but I was one of those people that was never, never, ever too proud to ask a gas station attendant or anyone else I could find for directions. Because when you know that you're really bad at something, it's not that hard to ask for help.
Yeah.
It's like, I remember, too, like the kinds of directions people would give. My dad is terrible at giving directions. He's the absolute worst. He's just, like, I don't even know if he can't. I can't even describe how bad he is. Like, he couldn't tell you the road. He couldn't even tell you how long. It's like, you go, you turn right, and it's actually even a left, and that's not correct. And whereas my mom would, like, give you a visual video as you're driving, and she'd write down every limb that you're getting to and the name of the road and what you're going to think about as you get close to it. And you know, there's this whole gamut of direction givers, and I always just, you know, I'm sure it's me, but I had terrible luck going to the gas station, and then they'd explain like I knew where I was going, and it's like, obviously I don't know where I'm going. Can you draw it because I could not verbally assimilate what they were saying to what I was doing, and I needed them to draw it. And they'd like give me a face like, no, I can't draw it.
Yeah.
My dad liked to give me north and south, east, west.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the worst.
And here in Colorado, it's not so bad.
Yeah, exactly.
You definitely have a point of reference. Mm-hmm. You know where west is. Mm-hmm. But back then when I was not yet in Colorado, I would tell him, is that left or right?
Yeah, exactly. Never since I moved to that was, you know, that was a real blessing, is when I got here, you could see the mountains. I was like, that's west.
Exactly.
But before that, I never could get where I was going, and I hated those stupid northwest directions. Yeah.
I love that you were going to people's front doors.
Multiple people's front eyes, Tennessee, and I mean, because you don't know, you don't see a gas station a lot. If you're off a highway, you're just going for the rest of your life, never on a gas station. You have to know where the gas station is to stop at the gas station.
So let me ask you now, now somebody comes to your door and they're lost because they have a weird flip phone from you know, however many years ago, or they left their phone, or their phone died and they haven't charged it, or who knows what, but they come to your door and they are lost.
Yeah.
What, and now they've knocked on your door. Sarah, what do you do?
I was so pleased when this actually happened. So I lived in Kentucky for a while, and I lived out in the country. I lived in this trailer out on a horse farm in Kentucky, and like, I don't even know how they got to where I was. So, you know, again, it's the situation where you're driving in the country and you are just far from all things. You know, there was like, I remember I used to say hi to a baby donkey every way I used to pass. There was like an abandoned house with vultures on it. It was out. And so one day this little car pulls up in my driveway in a rainstorm. Mm-hmm. And I'm in this trailer in the middle of nowhere. And all of these like little goth looking kids come out and they knock on my door, and I open it like, hello, yes. And then they look uncomfortable, but they're lost and their phone's dead, and can they please use my phone? And I was like, oh yes, please, Sarah's of the past, all of you, come in, come in, use my phone, I know exactly how you feel, please come in and use my, stay warm, would you like a glass of water? It was like the moment that I could finally, you know, help my past self in all of her misdirections. So
you returned the kindnesses that had been shown to you.
Of course.
Yeah. Not, well, I don't think, of course. I think that's, no, I think it's great. But I don't know. I mean, I don't, nobody's, I don't think, done this to me on my front porch. Every once in a while, I'll be walking somewhere and someone will be like, hey, do you know? And I always try to help them.
Maybe it's a matter of being in the country, too, because it is in the country when I have to stop at people's doors because there's nowhere else.
Yeah.
And I was living in the country when people had to stop at my door because you get lost in these weird places. And that's, you know, that's a lot of how he presents Scotland and why he went. He's like, Scotland, where there's no people. And it's still like that.
Yeah.
It's incredible. You go there and it's never touristy.
Yeah.
There's never many people. There's even in like whatever their tourist season is, it's fantastic.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, you go out to all these islands, there's nobody, you're by yourself at these monuments.
Did you draw those little goth kids a map?
I don't remember. I think I just let them use the phone and that was fine for them.
Okay.
But I'm still, you know, I have poor direction, sense of direction, so I don't know if I could have successfully got them where they wanted to go.
There are a couple times where I've been traveling and I'm, you know, in some other city or country and somebody says, oh, can I use your phone? And I can't, I'm trying to think now how I've responded because there's that, that would be that fear that this person is just going to take your phone and dash down a street. And, you know, I'm not the fastest runner in the
world.
And
as a tourist, that is, I like getting kind of... Doesn't robbed is it, I've also been robbed in other countries, so you do have to be careful.
Yeah, I have to. Yeah. So Wendy, somebody comes to your door now for help, and you're as excited as Sarah was when these kids piled out of the car. Was that the case or no?
I don't know if anyone's ever. You mean theoretically? Like,
what would you do? Yeah.
I guess it totally depends on the feeling I got in. After I opened the door, or looking through the peephole, as to whether I would trust them or not. A kid, much more likely, or a woman, much more likely to let them in. A strange man standing at the door, alone. I don't know.
You've got to get the sense that they're telling the truth.
Right.
You know, and you can get that. You can convey it, and you can understand it when people are trying to convey it. And if you don't get it, you're just being stupid to let them in.
Right,
but.
Right.
I once, several years ago, met some people downtown, and I was parked in a garage in Denver, and went back to my car, got in my car, door locked and all that, and then I'm like, you know, one of very few cars in this garage, and then I hear this noise that sounds like knocking, and I turn, I'm just sort of startled, turn, there's a guy standing at my window, and he does this motion, which is roll your window down motion, and and I sort of like, you know, this is the moment where we either, you know, our good sense kicks in, or we're just so startled we unroll the. So I unrolled it about half of an inch.
That's fair.
And I said, "Hey," and he said, "No, can you roll your window down?" And I said, "No." I said, "What is it?" He's like, "I really like your car."
Weird.
And I said, "Thank you." And he said, "No, it's just a really cool car."
Was it a cool car?
It was a Mini Cooper.
Okay, yeah, that's
so cool. I mean, but it's not a rare car.
No, but it's a cool car. There was nothing.
I don't know that at night in a fairly empty garage, a man should be knocking on a woman's window of her car.
That's
so. I just didn't roll the window any further. I just said thank you, appreciate it, and rolled it up. And then I started I put it in reverse and just started moving. But I thought when these things happen, we have just a moment, really. I mean, a very short period of time where we either make a great decision based on our judgment. I looked in that person's eyes. I let them into my house. Or I'm so startled and don't want to seem rude and mean, and I let them into my house and then regret it. And I kept thinking, like, this guy must have the kindest eyes on the planet. Richard Hannay.
Well, yeah, your car guy, I mean, he kind of started on the wrong foot. There, roll your window. No, roll it all the way down.
Yeah, he's before like, no, I say roll your window down. And I thought, this doesn't feel right. But I wasn't looking in his eyes, or it wasn't.
Well, you didn't
that.
Get
it
the
was
feeling.
More just situational awareness where I thought this is not right.
Yeah, that was funny too, because Richard actually did come upon some women where their men weren't home, and they still like let him in and gave him their ham and scones and whatnot and bowls of milk and helped him out. And he's like, I don't know what they thought, because of course they didn't ask any questions. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I think one of them, he's like, I think she thought I was a reformed burglar. But that is interesting. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling some of it's more like the culture of the time and how strangers or travelers or salespeople were treated.
Okay. So, I mean, do Wendy and Sarah, do you feel like you can judge a person fairly accurately when they first approach you out of nowhere? It's either at work in a business meeting, or it's on the street while you're traveling and somebody's looking for directions, or a friend of a friend, or I mean, it could be a million scenarios, but you meet somebody right off the bat, you look in their eyes and you say, yep, I got it. Like, do you feel that?
Not always. I'd like to think that I could feel it all the time, but I've been wrong in many instances. And so that's why I second guess whether I just don't know. Sometimes yes, but sometimes I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think it's an instant thing. And I don't think it was with Hannah either, because he talks to the people and he tells them the story and they get a sense of, is this real? Is this guy real? Is this guy a danger?
Right.
What's going on here? And I feel like, you know, you have to reach that point in a conversation where you're like, either you're not satisfied and you need to keep moving, or you are satisfied. Mm-hmm. I remember this funny thing happened the other day, and I am a lot more cautious now with the kids being small. Like, whereas I would engage with a stranger, maybe myself for whatever, because I think this is an interesting social experiment. With the kids are around, I'm much more like, who are you? What are you doing? But I parked in like the Santa Fe district the other day. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to go to a lighting store to see if they had any lighting. They didn't have any lighting. But I got out. And as soon as I got out, I got the stroller out. I had patients with me. I'm like trying to get her situated in the stroller. And this little person comes out of a door. And she's like, oh, baby. This and that, and is your baby allowed to have treats? You know, she wants to give my baby a treat. And I'm like, well, you know, we don't really do sugar. We do like fruit or whatever. And she's like, oh, well, I can give her some fruit. Come on in. And I'm like, ooh. Like, I just walked into that. And so I'm trying to get a sense of this lady. And I walk into her studio, and, you know, she's not speaking. She's speaking with an accent I can't quite place. And I don't, like, the studio has lots of windows. So all this, I'm just like, okay.
I know who this is.
Do you know her?
Yeah. She's, I'm trying to think of her name. She's really nice and so friendly.
Yeah, this tiny little, like, French Moroccan lady.
Yeah, that's her. Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
her.
Oh my gosh. She invited Michael and me to dinner.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You should go, great. Because she says she's a fantastic cook.
Yeah, no, she told us too. Yeah. She gave us a tour of her whole house. She lives behind it. Yeah.
So she lives behind the lighting store, and as you were strolling past her home, she invited you in?
Well, no, it was her gallery.
Oh, okay. That makes me feel better.
Yeah. So I didn't get to park.
Interesting that I knew exactly who you were saying.
So she went in the back.
What is her name?
She made a fruit smoothie. And then I'm like, crap. So I like taste the fruit smoothie first. And, you know, I let patients have, and patients, you know, she's digging it. She loves it.
Yeah.
And so we kind of slowly work our way, I think, into the situation of step by step trust.
Yeah.
But if you start by wanting to give my kid food, I'm going to be cautious.
Yeah, sure.
You know, more cautious than I would be for myself.
Super friendly woman. Just very friendly.
Yes.
Yeah. How interesting.
Yeah, she kind of started the Santa Fe Arts District, too. So if you're listening, you probably know who we're talking about. But.
I'm sure. I mean,
interesting.
She's probably listening. Others in this. Mm. I mean, why wouldn't they?
Obviously, she's listening. Thank you for the fruit smoothie.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Michael and I very much enjoyed you and may come over sometime for dinner. I don't know.
You should do it. Invite me. I'll go.
Yes.
We'll bring patience.
Yes.
She's a big fan of patience.
Well, who isn't a fan of patience?
I don't know. Everyone is.
Yeah. So, okay. So, yes.
That was a diversion from the book.
it is, but it's also related to the book, right? Because this guy, Richard Hannay, you know, he wins people over everywhere he goes. And I was sort of amazed by it because that is not a skill set I possess.
But have you tried? I think most people are decent people. And if they see you need help and you're telling the truth, most people will help you.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. So I've been approached various times with the, hey, I don't have any money.
Yeah.
My purse was stolen. My wallet was stolen. I need to catch the bus and do. And I have a lot of trouble with that.
It's usually not true.
Yeah. Because it's usually not true. Yeah, I mean, it gets really tricky. And I, like Wendy, I would like to think that I can read people well, but I don't always read people well. I sometimes read people very wrong. Or I think, this is the worst person ever, and they end up being the most amazing person ever. Or the opposite, where I'm like, oh, they're really awesome. And then, you know, 3 months into casually knowing them, I start seeing that, you know, they're complete crazy town, you know.
I'm not sure I've ever thought like someone's the best person ever and then they're the worst.
I'm exaggerating.
I mean, I've definitely gotten scammed, especially when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the whole, oh blah, this has happened to me. I've in Cleveland, people would go around and they even had newspaper articles they'd show you to be like, this is about me. Mm-hmm. And I just had to develop a policy of no thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, no thank you. I'm not giving out money. But that doesn't mean you can't help somebody.
Right.
I remember there was this little, I think I'm just saying an accurate thing to just say this diminutive crackhead in Cleveland who was known as such. And she, I was waiting for my friend outside of his meeting one night. And she was coming up to my car, and I was super poor. I was crazy poor at the time. She was coming up to my car asking for money. And I was like, no, I'm sorry. No, thank you. I can't give you any money. And she was also kind of like hallucinating. Mm. And then she gets out and she pulls out of her pocket like the most expensive brownie from the most expensive grocery store in Cleveland. And I, who was extremely hungry at the time, I was very, very jealous. Yes. You have that brownie and you're asking me for money? It's like the competition of poverty. You know, it's like, how dare you? But then later, you know, I gave her a ride. She wanted to go somewhere and I gave her a ride.
Nice.
Yeah, she gave me like her caseworker's phone number and it was a real surreal experience. But yeah, I just had to develop a non-monetary policy of helping, but
yeah,
these are just scammers. They're scammers for the scammers.
Yeah, it's tough. So Richard Hannay does this thing in the book where, you know, he meets up with this innkeeper at one point, and he thinks to himself, "Oh, innkeepers would make these great storytellers," and the innkeeper says, "Not really." And so this, so the innkeeper doesn't get a whole lot of people knocking on his door. He doesn't get a whole lot of people saying, hey, I need help, or hey, all of that kind of thing. The innkeeper says, maybe in the old days when you had pilgrims and ballad makers and highwaymen and mail coaches on the road, but not now. Nothing comes here but motor cars full of fat women who stop for lunch and a fisherman or two in the spring and the shooting tenants in August. I want to see life, to travel the world, write things like Kipling and Conrad. And then Hannay tells the innkeeper his story, because that's how Richard Hannay is. He like looks the guy in the eye and he's like, oh, I can trust this guy.
But it was a fake story. He told the innkeeper
story.
He only told Sir Harry the real story.
And then the innkeeper says, by God, it's all Rider Haggard and Conan Doyle. And so to me, there's this element of Scotland and 1915 and like the West has been won and there's nowhere else to go and explore. You know, it's part of like, I don't know, like later in the 20th century, the idea of the moon landing, that finally we found somewhere else to go and like new lands to explore. And But you feel like Scotland's this new land to explore. Like this guy, he's saying, yeah, in books, sure, but I want to really like live the stories in books. I want the adventure and all of the stuff that Richard Hannay is actually living out in this 1915 story, which I think is really fun and interesting that this book does that. It says essentially, like, when you're on the run and you get on the train and you go to Scotland, anything's possible. Like, you can get lost there. There are very few people there. You can hide out there. You can, like, it just feels like this land of adventure. It feels almost like the American West 100 mm-hmm. years earlier to yeah. me in reading it, or 50 years earlier or something like that.
Well, it's funny that the innkeeper's like, nah. It's boring. But I feel like that's the fault of the innkeeper, personally. Like, I feel like if you can't write a story about anything, then you lack imagination. Like, he's having all of these people come, mm-hmm. and he's just writing them all off as boring. Mm-hmm. Whereas nobody's boring. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a really interesting story. You don't have to be, like, in an espionage thriller to have an interesting story. Right. You can be, what is it, a bus full of fat ladies or something who stop for lunch. And that's very interesting if you actually listen to them and what mm-hmm. was going on. And in some way, it does remind me of, like, Kipling, who wrote a lot of almost parochial stories that were very just about either the animals were talking about boring stuff or like the people were just like ordinary people doing stuff. And he made it interesting. So mm-hmm. I kind of thought, like, well, you're young. You don't know what you're talking about, innkeeper. Mm-hmm. So that was my kind of take on the little innkeeper man.
Yeah. And like Kipling and, you know, Conrad, The Heart of Darkness, H. Rider Haggard, who wrote stories set in Africa, Conan Doyle, who has all of his mysteries, one of which, A Study in Scarlet, is partly set in Utah, of all places. They all have this sense of adventure because the place, the landscape, the story seems different than the day-to-day for a lot of the readers. And I would argue that the author of The 39 Steps does that in this book. He makes the story, even though it's set in Scotland, he makes the story feel like it's different and fresh and a big adventure and new, which is, I think, a pretty good accomplishment for 1915 in Scotland. They're not in the heart of Africa. They're not, no. You know.
Although Scotland, I think, is really considered the wilds okay. over there. I was on a train once in Scotland, and I met some British or English tourists. Mm-hmm. And that was their first time. It was my second time in Scotland. It was their first time in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, you know, we just never got here. It's just so far. And I'm like, is it so far? I'm just like, where you are, you can drive here. Yeah. So, And it is not very populated still. Mm, yeah. Still it's not.
Why is that?
I don't know. Mm. It's gorgeous. But outside of the large cities, you can just go forever. And it's not populated very heavily.
Yeah.
You know, it's very mountainous. I don't know. It's very forested still. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What was your thoughts, Wendy?
That sounds like paradise.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, I wasn't sure what the innkeeper was waiting for, mm-hmm. really. I mean, well, obviously he scored with Hannay because he gave him a really super fun story, uh-huh. and he got excited about it. But I kind of agree with your assessment, Sarah, that, come on, if you can't find anything to write about, mm-hmm. then maybe it's not everyone else. Maybe it's you, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
Like he's waiting for adventure to drop in his lap.
Right. Which you found with Hannay, but, you know, you shouldn't wait around for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was kind of my take when I was in photojournalism school. I would always just find anybody, mm-hmm. you know, and I'd start to get into their story and I'd want to mm-hmm. photograph it. I remember, oh, here's another instance of where I just walked up to a house. I used to walk to school every day, and my favorite house, I would watch them like doing construction on it. It was they were restoring an old Victorian. Mm-hmm. And one day I was like, I'm just going to walk up to the house. And I walk up to the house and I knock on the door and I'm like, hey, I love your house. Mm-hmm. I'm a photojournalism student. Could I photograph it? Mm-hmm. He was like, yes.
Oh, that's great.
And not only that, he had like done TV shows like American Castles. Oh. And he was like a producer. And his wife turned out to be the mayor of the town.
Wow.
And he introduced me to like another home restorer in the neighborhood who was like the world's 5-time disc golf world champion and like lived in a bus for the last 10 years till they bought a house in Kentucky. And it was like everyone I met, I feel like everyone I met was amazing if you just talked to them enough. In fact, I just remember one time I met this woman who had horses. And I thought, oh, this is so cool. I want to know more about this woman and her horse farm and her life. And she's the only person I ever met who was like, no. Like, why do you want to talk to me? I'm not interesting.
Oh.
And I'm like, but I think you're very interesting. And she's like, no, I'm not interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
And she was a hard no. You know, everyone else, you know, once you just start talking to them, everyone's so interesting. So... I don't know. What, Carolyn, you're a writer. What's your take about how do you write? Do you need a big story?
No. I mean, no. I don't wait for some story to fall into my lap or adventure to fall in my lap. I have to, I mean, if you're looking to write a story, you have to put something where once there was nothing. And you don't do that by sitting around hoping the right person knocks on your door. So I thought that was a little bit weird. But I felt that was maybe the author channeling these adventure stories he had read and loved and really doing a good job of creating this adventure story in the modern day in Scotland.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I appreciated what the innkeeper was saying on some level because it felt very contemporary. Like, oh, I'm running a B&B sort of thing, and the people who come by are maybe not the most fascinating people in the world. but by the same token, if you flip that script, maybe they are. You just assumed that they weren't because you took a visual scan of them. But then now we're back to this reading people on site. And so this innkeeper looks at people and says, nope, you know, nothing interesting there. So maybe he's not the best judge of character.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you do know he's pretty young, and I have to say, I was bad at it when I was young.
Yeah.
He says another funny thing I wrote down. He says, the only thing to distrust is the normal. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know how I feel about that sentence. Mm-hmm. Is that true? Is it not true? Is it true?
So the crazier the story, the more believable it is?
I don't know. You know as much as I do what he meant by that.
Well, in some aspects, I think that maybe the reason that people trusted Richard was because they thought no one could have made up this story. Mm. So maybe there is some merit to that. Maybe it is, if it's a crazy enough story, it might just be true. Mm-hmm. So I think to some extent that could be true. The only thing they suspect is the normal.
Yeah.
When someone tells you something that happens every day.
Yeah.
Or something they think you want to hear. Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely thought there's certain instances where that's definitely true. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't ever land on is this a truism? Mm. Is this a thing that's pretty much true?
Anything the innkeeper said, I didn't take away as let me write that down, because that was helpful. It was more like, he did seem young and impressionable and all of that. And then, so, Bullivant, right? There's the political leader. Mm-hmm. Sarah, you also wrote about this, and we have a bunch of notes in front of us. Listeners, and for the life of me, I have no idea where this is. But the political leader meets him. Hannay almost maybe, I think, totals this car.
Oh, Sir Harry.
Sir Harry.
Sir Harry, yeah, and Sir Harry crashes his stolen car into the river.
Oh, the police car?
Hanae crashes it.
Yeah, Hanae crashes it, sorry.
Right, and as Sir Harry's going out. And he meets Sir Harry. Sir Harry is this political, I think, leftist leader.
Yeah, the politics at that moment is confusing to me.
It was confusing. And Sarah, your comment, I think, had something to do with the fact that the guy sees that he's totaled the car, sees this guy just like standing there, and basically recruits him to speak at a political rally.
Yeah, his political rally, where he's about to give a speech.
Yeah. And so I think, Sarah, you called into question Sir Harry's judgment.
Well, Sir Harry, there was a lot of things. I was like, is this a believable guy?
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't ever. That's another thing. I was like, I couldn't quite land on an answer. So, yeah. Hanae crashes his stolen car, veers out of the way, crashes it in the river in front of Sir Harry. Sir Harry's like, oh, my goodness. But then he's immediately like, well, you're the right sort of chap. Come inside and I'll give you a suit. He's like, we'll have dinner afterward, but right now, he said the funniest phrase. He had to go do his speech, or like his agent would comb his hair or something like that. Comb his hair.
Yeah.
So he had to give the speech and like the political machinations. He'd lost his co-speaker, and you don't happen to be this kind of guy, do you? Hanae's like, oh, yeah, definitely I am. So he's like, you want to give a speech? Yeah. Totally going to give a speech.
It's the Australian point of view or something like that.
Yeah, he calls himself a colonial, and he's going to speak to, like, the Australian perspective. And that was interesting in and of itself. And
yeah.
So there's the first part where Sir Harry is, like, so self-focused that he has, like, not keying in on the absurdity of what he's asking this person to do.
Yes.
And then the second part is he's a horrible speech maker. And we're expected to, even though I have no understanding of like the politics at the time, we're expected to kind of go along with Hanae's evaluation that this was drivel, right? This was just a bunch of garbage that somebody has fed him.
Mm.
And he's just up there spouting garbage. It doesn't make any sense. And he also can't speak worth anything.
Mm.
But also, he's this totally stand-up guy who's like there for you in a pinch. And this is the guy that Hanae decides to like reveal the true story to, and gets him to leverage his godfather, who has all of this like political power and can actually make a difference. And so I was like, is this believable at all? I don't actually know. I feel like the current cultural vibe is very much probably too black or white, you know, like if you have dumb political feelings, then you're a dumb person, you know, or if I agree with your politics, then you're a smart person.
Yeah.
And I think obviously that's a little too flat, but also can you be completely inept at evaluating like ideas and speaking ability, but still be a trustworthy stand-up guy who's going to like be there for someone in a pinch?
So we discussed in our last podcast episode how Hanae says, I'm an ordinary sort of fellow, not braver than other people, but I hate to see a good man downed.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to avenge Scudder, or, you know, carry on Scudder's task with the government. And I feel like he identified somebody similar to himself in Sir Harry. A guy who was going to stand behind him and knew how to stand behind a cause. The cause might be good, bad, or other, but he was going to do it. So that's how I took that.
Yeah, he says a funny thing. He says, during his terrible speech, he says, you could see the niceness of the chap shining out behind the muck with which he had been spoon-fed. Yeah. So I don't know. It was just kind of an interesting character parse that I feel like might be lacking in a lot of current dialogue, or maybe it's just unrealistic, and that's why it's lacking. I don't know.
So, like, Wendy, why do you think the author put along Hanae's journey, so many people who were just willing to do whatever it took to help him. Like, what was the thought there?
Well, I think it was the theme of the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had to be successful in the end, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just to, you know, be very black and white. But, you know, as I sit here thinking more and more about his character, mm-hmm. you know, he did the same thing for Scudder in the very beginning.
Yeah.
He left the guy alone in his place. He didn't even know him. Think about how much he trusted this guy. Mm-hmm. So it was his nature, probably, to trust that everyone else would do the same for him. Mm-hmm. And I think it was just kind of the theme of the book. It was this honest guy is coming to us, telling us a truthful story, or he's super non-threatening to the women who would let him in and mm-hmm. feed him milk and whiskey. And I, you know, on that point, I wonder, was a whiskey to make sure he was subdued?
Or
like that thought occurred to me. I'm like, is that a safety protocol right there?
I thought it was a health whiskey. Like yeah. they kind of used it as a rejuvenation.
Oh, okay.
You're well, sick. You know, I better give you some whiskey.
Well, it could go either way, but that thought occurred to me. But in any case, I think it was just a presumption of innocence like he had in the very beginning of the book to help someone out. Mm-hmm. I don't know how realistic, but again, it was the book and it had to lend to his success in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe where he grew up in Rhodesia is sort of like Sarah's experience with Kentucky, where anytime you run across somebody, hey, how can I help you?
I got to tell you another story sometime, but I won't tell it today. I've got a good one about Kentucky and walking up to people's houses.
Yeah. Well, we have come to the end of another podcast episode, and we're reading another book next month.
Yeah. I'm super excited. I'm excited about our next book, The Mysterious Affair at Stiles. This is our first Agatha Christie. Woo-hoo. And I think nobody's not heard of Agatha Christie. So this story introduces amazing Belgian detective Hercule Poirot. The story was supposedly the result of a bet about the possibility of writing a detective story in which the reader would not be able to spot the criminal. Can you spot the criminal? I'll probably fail. You can buy a copy on Amazon, find a copy at your favorite local or online used bookstore, or read it for free, courtesy of Project Gutenberg. Check out our page on The Mysterious Affair at Stiles at teatonicandtoxin.com, and share your thoughts on our website or on our Facebook or Instagram pages at Teatonic and Toxin. And you might get a sticker.
And you just might get a sticker. Very well worth it. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
Wendy, you've been great.
Oh, thank you both so much. I was so excited and I'm thrilled to have been part of it.
You'll have to come back sometime.
Yeah, we love your horror.
Be careful what you ask for. Thanks, <Marsha.
laughs> No, that'd be awesome. Mm-hmm. That'd be great.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. And please, Wendy, stay mysterious.